Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated.
This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Wagner and Brown Limited and Kansas Energy Corporation versus Juan Norwood, Horwood, and David Lawrence Glass from Midland County, Robert Collins and others versus Shirley Eisen Newsom from Dallas County, and McAllen Medical Center Incorporated versus Romero Cortez Jr. and others from Hidalgo County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present arguments. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and will complete these arguments before the noon break. These arguments are being recorded, and you may purchase a tape of any argument from our clerk for a nominal fee. The court is pleased to welcome Mr. Wallace Jefferson of the San Antonio Bar with us today. Soon be joining the court and he'll be taking notes. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Wagner and Brown versus Horwood and Glass.
May it please the court, Mr. Arthur Estes will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, to date, this court has recognized two narrow exceptions to the imposition of statutes of limitations. The first being the discovery rule, which is analyzed by the type of case or by a category of case, and the second being fraudulent concealment or fraud, which is analyzed on a fact-specific basis by applying the facts of a specific case to the elements of the doctrine of fraudulent concealment. The El Paso Court of Appeals in this case, we believe, has added yet a third exception that blends the elements of each of the prior exceptions without requiring satisfaction of the strict standards of either. The El Paso Court began by categorizing the case at bar as an underpayment of royalty case, but it went on to hold that the injury must be inherently undiscoverable if the only source of information available to the plaintiff would be the defendant or the operator in this instance. Furthermore, the El Paso Court went on to apply the facts of that specific case, analyzing the facts of that specific case to its discovery rule analysis and held that the discovery rule was applicable to this underpayment of royalty case.
You didn't find that the Court of Appeals erred by failing to apply the statute category.
Yes.
What category would you base your argument on? That seems to be the difficulty here, determining what is the category you seek.
It is. You could begin very broadly, and as you go each step more narrowly, of course, you become more case-specific, which seems to be contrary to the goals of Altai and SV. The broadest category, of course, would be breach of implied covenants or express covenants under
Oligan. And let me rephrase my question. I understand the different possibilities, but how would you direct us to choose which category?
We don't see that there would be any meaningful distinction between applying the category as the breach of express or implied covenants under an oil and gas lease, rather than go through each potential covenant and each potential fact situation that would apply to those covenants. Nevertheless, the El Paso Court did select underpayment of royalty as a category of case, which probably would have worked fairly well had they stayed there and not continued to work the facts of that specific case into that broad category.
Now, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that in terms of working the facts of the case into the circumstance.
They basically took a couple of, we believe, paid inordinate attention to a couple of facts and their view of those facts, particularly the statements themselves, the revenue statements that Wagner and Brown would send out to the royalty owners, which showed a net payment rather than showing what the gatherer was actually being paid by the purchaser, and a 1985 telephone conversation between Mr. Glass and a Wagner and Brown employee.
Well, then, is your category then breach of express or implied warranty that results in underpayment of royalties?
Yes.
As opposed to other types of damage that may flow in the context of an oil and gas dispute?
I think that the category would be those cases seeking damages, underpayment of royalty in this instance, for...
But would it make a difference? And I'm puzzled, as Justice O'Neill is, about how we define the category. The case that you all rely upon, the Heckey decision, didn't involve a similar fact situation, and so that's what causes the question to arise in my mind, that in deciding as to that category of cases, we did have to look at the facts to determine whether or not the discovery rule applied. Are these facts sufficiently different, even though it is a breach of express or implied warranty case, to justify a separate category and for us to have to apply the analysis to determine whether or not the discovery rule should be applied?
We do not believe that they are.
Okay, and why not?
We don't believe so for these reasons. There are still a large number of sources for information other than simply the operator, but the Heckey opinion very carefully pointed out that that would be one of the first places that you would go, and that if they failed to tell you the truth, then you would move over to fraudulent concealment. But you would have information available from the operator, from the gatherer in this instance, from the gas purchaser, from audits or other professional help, such as Mr. Glass availed himself of. And when you move the analysis over to the type of case rather than this specific case, we don't see any meaningful distinction between this and Heckey. It is clearly factually distinguishable. And we read Altai and those other cases to say, try to stay away from factual distinction and apply these unifying principles or these tests to a category of case to determine whether or not limitations.
But the question is, how broad is the category? And the question is, are you asking us to decide that in all cases involving a breach of express or implied warranty involving the payment of royalties, regardless of what the facts may be or the type of damage that is claimed, which may mean that there are different kinds of claims, actually.
Absolutely.
That we should at this point in time pronounce that the discovery rule applies for all time, or is it your position maybe that we already did that in Heckey?
That certainly it was our view of reading Heckey when we argued this case to the trial court. But I would point out the general unifying principles apply to all of those underpayment of royalty type cases, even though you have different types of underpayment cases. You have the case where you sell a different amount of product than you produce, or as in this case, the unreasonableness or the alleged unreasonableness of post-production costs. But the principles remain the same, and the guiding principle is, of course, that it's a commercial relationship, and the royalty owner has a duty of its own diligence that cannot be ignored in any test to follow through on that and to keep up with that on a specific basis. The danger of going narrower and narrower is you'll lose the benefit of consistency and certainty that was gained in the trilogy of cases recently decided if suddenly courts and lawyers begin saying, well, this is factually distinguishable. In that case, the royalty statement said this. In this case, it said that. And you run a real danger of going back to the what I would call the pre-Altai confusion, where each case kind of stood on its own, whether there was a discovery.
Would it be fair to characterize this as really a dispute over marketing arrangements?
That is an accurate characterization. I do think that.
And the royalty is how you measure potential damages, but the actual dispute is over how the gas was actually marketed.
I believe that to be the case. The plaintiff's claims. Because of the way the gas is sold in this instance and has been being sold and gathered since 1975, really come back around to a deduction from price, even though it's not a deduction that the operator makes. And so the complaint really is a marketing arrangement, but it's interesting that it's a marketing arrangement that's been in place since the mid-70s. And each of these plaintiffs in this instance acknowledged that they knew it was in place, they knew who to call for Canyon Matters, they knew who to call for Wagner and Brown Matters, and in fact did so on other issues whenever necessary, that although they are, if you will, related entities, they perform separate business functions, and they knew which performed which. And in fact, Mr. Glass said he began investigating that relationship as far back as 1983, and I assume that he meant by that, consistent with the court's question, whatever that marketing arrangement was. The second portion, other than the inherently undiscoverable, where we think this case fails on a discovery rule analysis, is the objective verifiability standard. That requires, in reading SV versus RV, direct physical evidence that in and of itself establishes the injury.
Well, I'm a bit confused on this point. If the sole claim is that whether the fees were excessive, and I can see how that would be subject to expert interpretation. But I understand that they've raised some of their claims in terms of a simple misrepresentation on the statement for which there is no expert witness testimony.
No, the sole claim is the unreasonableness of post-production costs. In their response to the petition for review, they act as though a fraud measure of damages would apply, that is, what was as represented versus what Canyon was actually receiving. But that's nowhere in the pleadings there. The summary judgment was heard prior to the class certification hearing in this case. There were no fraud pleadings extant, only pleading of fraudulent concealment. And the only measure of damages sought are whether or not the post-production charges were reasonable.
So there is no claim for misrepresentation?
No. The only thing that's in this case is the doctrine of fraudulent concealment. And in fact, you will note in the deposition excerpts that we quote in there, that's what we were questioning Mr. Glass and Horwood about. Did you know you had intended fraudulent concealment, and can you tell us where that fraudulent concealment is?
Isn't that the flip side? I mean, if it's fraudulent concealment, isn't the flip side of that argument that the statements didn't accurately reflect what was actually being charged and therefore misrepresentation?
Well, first of all, we would argue that whether or not they did accurately reflect what was being charged, because what was being charged against their account was accurately reflected. But whether they argue that or not, it doesn't change the fact. The case they brought was for breach of express and implied covenant as a result of unreasonable post-production charges. And the measure of damages for that can only be the difference between an unreasonable charge and a reasonable charge. It has nothing to do with the statements. The statements come up only in the context, we believe, of the fraudulent concealment claim to avoid the bar of limitation. And that's part of what we thought was in error about the El Paso court. They kind of mixed that apple with the orange, if you will, of the discovery rule analysis. But if you look at the pleaders, and you see, you can look at their experts' affidavits, what they're seeking solely is a measure of damages for unreasonable post-production charges. And that is, in fact, as the court pointed out, necessarily subjective. The reasonableness analysis, the amount of the charges themselves are not a matter of dispute, and they are in fact objective. But to get to the injury, or the wrong, if you will, you have to say that charge that's not in dispute is reasonable or unreasonable, which is a matter of judgment and a matter of expert opinion, which it appears to us leads to precisely the swearing match of experts warned against in SB versus RB.
Mr. Estes, may I ask you about the fraudulent concealment that you've been discussing. Your opponents say that's not an issue on this appeal because it wasn't raised. And I'm confused on the procedural aspect of where the case is, since the Court of Appeals acknowledged there were two grounds that the royalty owners were alleging, but didn't discuss fraudulent concealment, and it's not in your petition or your brief on the merits. Exactly where are we, and who did what and when, and can we talk about it if we write on it?
We believe that clearly the court can address it in the 1998 case.
Am I right that in the trial court, since you were the movement, you had the burden to show there were no material facts on a fraudulent concealment defense?
On fraudulent concealment, they have the burden to raise a fact question as to each and every element of fraudulent concealment. We had the burden to prove as a matter of law that there was a bar of limitations.
So it's different. It's exactly the reverse from the discovery.
It is, Your Honor. And when you
because
try
it is an affirmative defense rather than a total.
That's correct. And they failed in that burden principally.
Well, the trial court agreed.
The trial court
with you.
Trial court
didn't
agreed with us.
Raise
the
fact question. But then when we get to the Court of Appeals, they mention it but never discuss it. I don't see any citation to a fraudulent concealment case in their writing whatsoever. So when it comes here, who has to do what to draw an issue on that?
It's optional with this court to consider that in the first instance.
So is it your view then, because they raised it in their response, that we do have the issue before us?
It is, Your Honor. In fact, it's our view that surprisingly in their response, that's what they led with, is
well, they,
please remand.
Sent us a letter saying they disagree. I'm sure you got a copy of
that. I did, Your Honor. We disagree with that. We think that there are a couple of fairly recent cases from this court that indicate that you can consider that in the first instance. The record is before you. The fact of the matter is, in the El Paso opinion without citation to authority, and their briefing in this case without analysis under fraudulent concealment, we discussed all of the facts on which they rely for fraudulent concealment. The record is before the court, and this court can make that determination in the first instance as a matter of law. And we believe in the interest of judicial economy should do so. We can understand why.
Well, we do have an option to send it back for the Court of Appeals to write on. Would you agree with that?
You do have that option. It would appear to us to be more convenient for all to go ahead and address it here, because we think all of the facts have been thoroughly discussed here. We didn't make the choice that was made in their briefing to try to make this a fact-specific argument. We were trying to stay with the type case. But having made that choice, they want to worry you with these facts and then say, but don't worry about that now. If you don't like what we're saying, send it back to the El Paso Court of Appeals. We think it should be determined here and can be determined here, but it's certainly within this court's discretion to do it either way.
Mr. Estes, would it be helpful or not in trying to determine the category which the discovery rule applies or does not, in terms of the causal connection to the claim and its causal connection to the damages asserted. It seems to me in this case, it is not so much the breach of warranty that's the category that ought to, is it a broad category or a narrow category? It really seems to me the concern is, what's the nature of the wrongfully caused damages? Since the nature of the wrongfully caused damages is underpayment of royalty, and the party receives the run checks and sees that, it seems to me the category could be in a case where the claim is underpayment. The claimant obviously has the information or access to information on how their payment was calculated. They just go to the person that gave them the payment and say that. If they claim that it's misrepresented to them, they're claiming that you say moves from a discovery rule claim to a fraudulent concealment claim, which gives them the opportunity to say, I know I had that information, but they lied to me, and they also escaped from it. But couldn't the category of cases, would it be helpful to look at categories in terms of what's claimed to be the wrongfully caused damages to determine whether or not that's what's inherently undiscoverable, if those damages are now claimed to be discoverable?
I think that's correct, because the test is actually stated as to whether or not the nature of the injury in cases of that type would be inherently undiscoverable. And here, as in any other underpayment case in a commercial context, whether it be royalty or commercial leases or anything else, you're talking about a claim for money damages under a commercial contract. And that is, in fact, the nature of the injury. And the inquiry should be as to whether or not the fact of that injury was inherently undiscoverable.
Does it make any difference if the category was the category could be underpayments under a commercial contract, as opposed to category being oil and gas cases involving breach of warranty?
Absolutely. There's no logical reason that I can define to differentiate between the two, because the leases are, at their core, commercial contracts between parties.
Does it matter what the runs look like, or in the other context, whatever the documentation looks like that the person paying gives to the payee in determining whether or not the discovery rule should apply?
I don't believe that it does, because you still have all of these other sources of information. You can still contact the operator and question them and seek more information from them.
So what we're saying now is that every two or three months they're going to have to ask you for an accounting.
I don't
make sure that you give all the breakdown, or they're going to have to sit down and talk with you to say, now tell me how you calculated this.
I don't think that's what they would have to do at all. In fact, the record is very clear that they can calculate these. Their own expert said how they can do that and calculate the charges being made against their account. And in fact, the evidence in the record is very clear that had they done so, they would have seen the contractually called for escalation of the compression fees, even from 85 to 92, well before 92, we had fees beyond what their experts now contend are reasonable.
But if we're talking about a broader category of underpayment in any kind of a commercial context, we may have a payment document that would not allow someone to do that, and in fact would have to do an outside investigation in order to determine why they were being paid the amount they were being paid.
I think that's accurate. I think it becomes an economic decision, though. They are, in fact, commercial contracts, and how much detail or trouble you want to go to keep up with them are very different, as seen by the two plaintiffs in this.
But it may also affect how broad the category should be for application of the discovery rule.
It may well do that, Your Honor. You know, in reviewing the facts of Altai in particular, that's certainly no less fair than the burden that was placed on Computer Associates in that instance. And that doesn't make it right or wrong. It just gives us consistency that we know to follow in the law.
I have one quick question. On the objective verifiability prong, we said in SB versus RV that it is possible that recognized expert opinion on a particular subject could be so near consensus. You're familiar
yes.
with that language
yes,
that it would satisfy that element. Since you have a burden to disprove the discovery rule, is it your burden to show that there is a lack of consensus, or do they need to show that there is nearly a consensus?
I think that when the standard is reasonableness, there can be no consensus. But we showed that our experts, or are the people who opined in our instance, said that the charges were reasonable. Their experts used a methodology that they said was came to the conclusion that it was not reasonable, even though the I think the question is burden, and I may be getting off on methodology. It is our burden, and we think we met that burden by showing that two experts could disagree in this instance. And they're clearly, in determining reasonableness, can be no consensus. There may be a consensus as to the methodology, but by its very nature, reasonableness is going to require some sort of subjective application. I've done the work. I've done the comparative analysis. Now, where in that range does the reasonableness cut off? And we believe that that's well in this record, and it presents an excellent opportunity to define that better in a commercial context.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Levon Hove-Natanian will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Levon Hove-Natanian, and along with Mr. Rob Herring, I represent the respondents in this case. I want to begin by addressing Justice Baker's question on fraudulent concealment. Mr. Estes is correct that we led off in our response, our brief on the merits, with the issue of fraudulent concealment. But if the court will recall, we led off with that issue by saying it is not an issue. We spent two or three pages telling the court our opinion, suggesting to the court that because they did not brief fraudulent concealment cannot be an issue in this case. On top of that, we submitted
the
letter.
Why do they have to
brief it? I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
Why do they have to brief it?
Well, Your Honor, because of the unique procedural posture of this case, there was a summary judgment granted, as the court knows, in the trial court. We raised two affirmative bars to the defensive limitations on which the summary judgment was granted, fraudulent concealment and the discovery rule. The El Paso Court of Appeals concluded the discovery rule applies and reversed the case and therefore did not address fraudulent concealment. Now, on appeal, the petitioner's position is the El Paso Court of Appeals was wrong in fraudulent concealment, or I beg your pardon, on the discovery rule to say that the discovery rule acted as a bar to limitations. In that event, even presuming they're correct, even presuming this court were to agree, we still have a fraudulent concealment bar that has not been adjudicated.
Yes.
And so for that reason...
Well, why don't we adjudicate it?
Well, Your Honor, you could, but for the fact that they have not briefed it. They haven't told this court, here are the reasons that fraudulent concealment wouldn't apply, and we should win even if the court agrees, even if the court agrees with us on the discovery.
But do you agree with his comment that fraudulent concealment is an affirmative defense, and you had the burden in the trial court to raise a fact issue on every element, as opposed to their burden in the trial court to show as a matter of law that the discovery rule didn't apply?
Not, Your Honor, not necessarily. No, I don't necessarily agree. I think the cases are fairly well split on that. There are some cases that say, regardless of whether you're talking about estoppel or fraudulent concealment or the discovery rule, it's the movement for summary judgment on the basis of limitations that has the duty to negate.
I thought our jurisprudence is very clear that there's a dichotomy between discovery rule and fraudulent concealment. That even in summary judgment, the burden is on it's on you to affirmatively establish fraudulent concealment, not on the summary judgment.
Your Honor, I think that's correct. I think this court has basically cleared it up. I know the cases to
well,
which
then
you
why
referred.
Did you say it was unclear? I'm not following. I thought you said it was unclear, and now you're saying it's clear.
Well, Your Honor, now it's me that's certainly unclear. Let me just backpedal just for a second. I think there was a split in the case law. I think this court, in two successive cases that are cited in the letter that we sent to the court last week, specifically stated there is a difference in fraudulent concealment and the discovery rule. In fact, the court specifically said there are different procedural rules, there are different burdens, there are different shiftings that go on. So for that particular purpose, I don't disagree. I do agree with Mr. Estes. I do agree, obviously, with Justice Owen, that the ultimate burden on fraudulent concealment is on us. But the point is, while that may be true in the trial court, and the trial court said that we didn't meet that burden, it's their burden on appeal to raise it as an issue.
Well,
they
Judge Baker
the
asked you about the trial court, and you said it was unclear, but now you say, no, you agree with him. You agree with Judge Baker?
I do agree with Judge Baker. That's correct, Your Honor. I do. I think ultimately this court cleared it up. But
you're saying in the Court of Appeals, you raised as a point of error, you were the appellant, you raised as a point of error the trial court's failure to accept your affirmative defense by granting their summary judgment. The Court of Appeals didn't address your point of error.
Exactly.
They left it because they disposed of it on a different point.
Exactly.
And you won in the Court of Appeals, and your point is when you got to the Supreme Court, it was the petitioner's obligation to challenge both grounds upon which the Court of Appeals could have, its judgment could be supported.
Exactly right.
Which were the two you brought on appeal.
Exactly.
If we decide that you're wrong on the discovery rule, we still have to address the fraudulent concealment question, but you're arguing that question is not before us because the petitioner didn't raise that unaddressed point out of the Court of Appeals.
I wish I had just said that. The answer is absolutely correct.
All right, then why can't we write on it anyway?
Well, Your Honor, you can't write on it because the only time they've ever raised
it. What about Cincinnati versus Cates?
Your Honor, that's true. Cincinnati versus Cates is out there, but this case would go far beyond Cincinnati versus Cates because one of the elements in Cincinnati versus Cates is did the appellant or the petitioner preserve the error? They haven't preserved the error here because they have not argued it to this court.
Well, they preserved it in the issue's preserved in the Court of Appeals because you brought it there.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So at least we could send it back to the Court of Appeals.
Precisely. That's exactly right. And I think that's the difference in a remand and a render. If they had argued fraudulent concealment, and this court could have determined, well, we disagree with the respondents on the discovery rule, we disagree with the respondents on fraudulent concealment, we're going to reverse the El Paso Court of Appeals, and we render judgment for the petitioners, because you can't win respondents on fraudulent concealment or discovery rule or estoppel, then this court could do that. But without briefing on fraudulent concealment, the most this court could do would be to remand it to the El Paso Court of Appeals and say, they briefed it in your court, you figure it out. Now, it's true that they briefed it in their reply brief, the petitioners in this court, briefed it in their reply brief. But
there's the possibility, if you hadn't said anything at all in your response, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's a possibility. And the reason I don't is because in their brief, they do mention fraudulent concealment in their opening brief. Now, they don't mention any of the three elements of fraudulent concealment. They don't cite a single case that would apply here on fraudulent concealment. They don't go through any analysis on fraudulent concealment. But they do mention it. And that was enough to raise our antenna to come in and say, wait a minute, let's talk about what the issues are in this case. And they don't include fraudulent concealment. At the risk of beating a dead horse, I want to point out that the appellate rules are very clear that when you set out your issues to tell this court what your case as petitioners is about, you've got to do it in your issues presented, not just to let this court know, but to let the other side know.
Can we focus a little bit more on the merits of the claims?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Would it be fair to say that what you're really complaining about is the way the gas was marketed?
Your Honor, that would not be fair to say. Marketing is a part of it, but that's not all of it. Our ultimate complaint boils down to the fact that they have shorted us on royalties.
But because of the way they market, because of the arrangement with their affiliate.
Your Honor, not so much because of the arrangement, because we don't have a, let me be real specific, we don't have a problem with them deducting compression charges, for instance, from the price of gas. Our problem is their compression charges are unreasonable.
That's my point. You're saying that they're making money on the side with an affiliate by virtue of the way they're marketing the gas.
That's correct.
And I want to ask you a few questions about the statement. The statement, does it accurately show the gross price that the operator says it received for the gas?
Your Honor, I will defer to Mr. Herring on that.
I believe it did show accurately what the gross price for gas
was. And then you obviously know what the net price you received was. And so you could determine on a global basis what was deducted. Why would it be difficult for a royalty owner to ask the operator for the agreements under which the gas is being marketed so that they could determine when they read the agreements between the operator and the gatherer and the purchaser what precise arrangements were? Why would that be a difficult thing?
It wouldn't be, Your Honor. It wouldn't be difficult, but the problem in this case was Mr. Horwood and Mr. Glass never knew they needed to.
But if they'd done that, would they have been able to figure out who was getting what charges?
I don't think so, because for one thing, it took an expert for us to figure that out. So I certainly don't think Mr. Horwood and Mr. Glass, who are not proficient in this field and certainly not lawyers and certainly not oil and gas
lawyers. Based on your briefs, I mean, it seems to me that your arguments are laid out in the briefs based on the contractual provisions themselves.
That's correct.
And so if you'd had the contracts, if you'd asked for the agreements and gotten them, you could have laid out the same arguments that you laid out in your brief.
Correct, Your Honor, and that it would have been possible. Absolutely, it would have been possible. But the problem.
Why should we fashion a rule that says royalty owners shouldn't at least be obligated to ask for the marketing agreements if they have questions?
Well, Your Honor, because what we did in this case was better. We went directly to the lessee and said, what are you charging us for compression charges? I mean, we did even better than looking at the contracts. We went right to the source.
And they told you what was true. What they didn't tell you was the arrangement with the affiliate,
which you
could have learned about had you asked for the agreement.
But respectfully, Your Honor, what they told us was not true. What they told us was, we're charging you 12 cents in compression charges, and that has come down from 30 cents.
But that's a fraud claim. That's not a discovery rule problem.
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, if you go and ask somebody, are you cheating me, and they say no, and they are, then you've got a fraud claim.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor,
that doesn't mean that's the discovery rule applies.
Well, I have to disagree. I think fraudulent concealment is in there. I think fraud is in there, but I think that's also a discovery rule problem as well. For the very reason that the two elements of the discovery rule, the first element is it inherently undiscoverable, would apply there.
And you say in your brief, the royalty statement showed the compression charge.
Well, Your Honor, they didn't state, here's your compression charge. They gave the information.
I'm just quoting from the brief.
Correct.
And then it says, on the same page, OilSafe reported to Mr. Glass that he was being overcharged.
Correct.
How is that inherently undiscoverable?
Well, Your Honor, because at that point, Mr. Horwood, or rather Mr. Glass, was faced with the option of running to the courthouse and bringing suit, or going to his lessee with whom he had done business for years and years, and telling them, I've got this auditor over here that says you're doing me wrong. What do you have to say about that? And they reassured him, no, it's 12 cents. That's all we're charging you, 12 cents. And it's come down from 30. And at that point, he said, okay, well, I believe these people with whom I've done business for years and chose not to file suit.
That's your choice, but I don't see how that makes it inherently undiscoverable if there is an expert out there that you employed that was actually discovering it.
Well, Your Honor,
if it was an overcharge, as you said.
I see the distinction you're making. I guess I should retreat to the Advent case because that case speaks to that. The Advent case, Advent Trust versus Hyder, says that when you only have one potential source to get that information from, and that source gives you wrong information, that fits under the discovery.
Well, say you think your doctor mistreated you. You go to another doctor and you say, do you think this doctor mistreated me? He says, yes, I surely do. So you go back to your first doctor and you say, did you mistreat me? No, I didn't. You would say the discovery rule applies to that case.
Your Honor,
if you've got a doctor telling you you were mistreated.
Well, but see, I think the difference would be that in that case, you've got two doctors, either one of which could tell you, yes, you've been misdiagnosed or mistreated. In our case, despite what the petitioners say this morning, there was only one place we could go to get this information, and that was the lessee.
Why didn't Allstate have it? I don't understand why you would pay Allstate if you didn't think you were going to get something useful from it.
Well, we did get something useful from it, Your Honor, and as to how they got their information, I'm not certain. I don't think the record speaks to that. But let me respond to what Mr. Estes says, though, about the other potential sources. The gas purchasers, for instance, and the processors and the gatherers, not only did they not have a duty to tell us if we had inquired from them what is the compression charge, not only does the record not indicate that all of them knew that information, but again, we did better. We went right to the source of the compression charge.
I thought what we said in HECI was go to the operator first. So you don't have a discovery rule problem. Then if the operator affirmatively misleads you, you might have a fraudulent concealment problem.
That's correct.
But that's not a discovery rule problem.
That's virtually a quote from that case, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. But the court didn't say you would not have a discovery rule problem. The court just said, if, of course, they're telling you something that's untrue, then you would be able to rely on fraudulent
concealment. I thought that was implicitly in HECI that these royalty owners in that case could have asked the operator what was going on. They didn't do that.
Well, Your Honor, if I may respectfully quibble with you just for a minute, what the court said in that case was that the meals went to HECI, and HECI was entirely forthcoming and told them everything accurately that the meals asked, which makes our case sort of the anti-Hecky.
But we said categorically, I thought later in the opinion, that in these cases where they're a source of information and the best source is the operator, that the royalty owner has some obligation to inquire. And that then if they make inquiry and there's false information given, you might have a fraudulent concealment problem, but it's not a discovery rule problem.
Your Honor, I think that's you obviously know the case better than I, but I think that's a fair characterization. I completely agree. I think just, though, that the difference and the reason that this case is a square peg into the square hole of the discovery rule and HECI was not, is because there was no other place for us to go.
Mr. Habitat,
I have a question about that. The argument, Mr. Estes, as I understand, responds to yours, is that buying your argument essentially means you don't know whether the discovery rule applies until at the end of the trial you prove that there was misinformation given. And so if you don't reach the threshold of fraudulent concealment, I have a statement. It lists what the charges are. Deducting all those charges produces a bottom line number. I either know I'm overcharged or I don't know I'm overcharged. You're saying I don't know I'm overcharged. It all adds up, but I don't know that these charges they are higher charges. You say it's inherently undiscoverable because the only person I can go to for the source is the person who made the charge, and I go ask them, and they say, no, it's not an overcharge. And you say, therefore, it's not discoverable.
That's correct.
But you don't know that's not discoverable. Meaning you don't, how do I prove it's an overcharge? Until you go to the jury, and the jury says, yep, that was an overcharge number, therefore the discovery rule applies, therefore it's not too late to bring suit. Mr. Estes says, that's the logical result of your saying this isn't a fraudulent concealment where they give me misinformation, this is simply an inability to discover what the right information was. Seems to me he has a strong argument that that you can't get there the way you want to go?
Well, Your Honor, if I can respond to that. First of all, I think that it can fit into both categories, fraudulent concealment and the discovery rule. But the point that I want to make is that when it comes to the discovery rule, I'm trying to figure out how I can best put this. If there's only one source we can go to, and they give us wrong information, and all we are trying to do in this context is raise a fact issue on the discovery rule, then to avoid summary judgment limitations, then in this case, that would be enough. If this were an appeal from a jury verdict, then I think Mr. Estes might have a point. But in this case, we're trying to blow up a wisp of smoke. All we're trying to do is raise a fact issue. We've raised a fact issue that, number one, at the least, we've raised a fact issue that the information was wrong, and we've at least raised a fact issue on the fact that we couldn't know that except from the lessee, and we raised at least a fact issue on the fact that when we went to them, they gave us wrong information.
Well, does this destroy the value of Altai then?
Oh,
Altai was predicated on the notion that through reverse engineering, you could find these stolen source codes. Your argument is applying it to Altai. If Altai's expert that they had do the reverse engineering gave them the wrong information so that they didn't know the source code had been used, then the discovery rule would apply. So Altai, the predicate of Altai, which is they could, by investigation, discover, is destroyed by the very notion that if they use that investigation and fail to discover it, then the discovery requires. So how is this not going your direction? You just destroy the applicability, I mean the value of Altai, isn't it?
I think I see what you're saying, Your Honor. You're saying we've got the cart before the horse and then we've got the cart after the horse as well. How can it work in both directions? If I'm understanding your question correct.
Well, Altai was predicated on the fact that through reverse engineering you could discover this.
Right.
The argument Mr. Essex says, well, you got the bill. Through reverse engineering, you could discover the overcharge. You're saying, but the person who gave us the information, when we asked them, they gave us the wrong information.
Well, Your Honor, and more fundamental than that, we got the bill, but the bill was wrong. The bill gave the wrong numbers. That's why it would not work in this particular case. There's summary judgment evidence in the record that the figures that were stated on the royalty statements that were used to calculate the compression charges were wrong.
Well, they're only wrong because of the marking arrangements. I mean, they purport to show what they purport to show. They just weren't the whole picture.
Your Honor, I think they're wrong as a matter of mathematics. Now, I'm not saying they don't add up on the royalty statement. They do. We've done the calculations. What I'm saying is, and maybe we're agreeing, the contracts, the marketing arrangements, call for X compression charge. The royalty statement said, well, we're charging you Y. And that's where what they were putting on the statement, as long as it was not X, it was wrong.
Mr. Habitania, verifiability
problem, if I could.
Sure.
And I'm confused on your claim, and this is a question I directed to your opposing counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
Is your claim confined to a battle of the experts on excessiveness?
No, it is not, Your Honor.
All right, well, give me your damage model based on simple misrepresentation on the statement.
Well, Your Honor, it goes further than the simple misrepresentation on the statement.
You have to have an expert on excessiveness to get there, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
In this court.
So then why aren't you bound by a battle of the experts here? It doesn't depend on whose expert the jury believes.
Well, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why that doesn't hurt us, because this court in SV versus RV said, and Your Honor pointed this out earlier, if you have expert testimony in connection with your hard and fast physical evidence.
Well, I don't particularly read it that way. What would be the difference in a medical expert saying, I think that there was negligence here, and because I've got the medical reports, which is objective data, then somehow it meets that test? Which seems to me to be what you're arguing.
Your Honor, I'm out of time. Let me ask the Chief Justice, and may I then respond to Justice Haynes?
I may have one for you.
Thank you. Let's not go too far. No, thank you. I appreciate that. Your Honor, could you rephrase that, please? I'm sorry.
Well, you seem to be saying because there's objective data to back up an expert's opinion, then therefore you get over this hurdle.
Right.
But there's always objective data to back up any expert opinion. I mean, the question is whether the ultimate determination is one of opinion, it seems.
I think that's true, Your Honor. I think, but see, that what we have in this case, we have financial records that show here's what they told us they were charging us, and by that I mean the rural estates. We have other records, like the contracts to which Justice Owen was referring, that says here's what we were really charging.
Right, so why, but to get to your victory in this case, you have to have an expert give a subjective opinion.
Well,
and there are going to be two different subjective opinions based on the objective data.
It would depend on which damages model you, or I guess we, use. If we're going to get an expert to come in, and we already have two of them, to say that I looked at the amount of the fees, the post-production and compression charges, and that's too high, then that is an objective standard, and we've got the hard and fast data.
Too high is not an objective standard.
Okay. I guess what I mean to say is they're unreasonable, and I guess that is not
an objective
standard.
You're going to have
standard.
Set of objective
That's
standards.
Right.
And
that's
one
right.
expert's going to say too high, and one expert's
He's
going to
say, no, it's
fine. It's
fine. That's right.
So, again, why aren't you into a battle with the expert?
Well, I chose the wrong adjective. That's not an objective standard, but that is one way we can show our damages. The other way is to simply look at the two sets of figures. On the one hand, you've got what they're charging us, and on the other hand, you've got what they say they're charging us. And as a matter of math, those things don't.
All right, but then I keep coming around into the circle. That's your misrepresentation claim. But you can't get to damages without a determination of excessiveness, correct?
Your Honor, I suppose that's true. But I think there is an excessiveness determination in there. I think a jury could conclude that what they're telling you... Exactly correct. Exactly right. I think a jury can conclude from that, without any expert testimony whatsoever, that, yeah, that breaches the contract. That breaches the express terms. It breaches the implied covenant to manage and administer, and from there. And
Mr. Hovnatanian, you obviously take the position that the category of cases that Heckey determined did not fall within the discovery rule is different than the category of cases that this case would fall in because the discovery rule should apply.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you define the category of cases that Heckey determined were excluded from the application of the discovery rule, and how would you define the category of cases that this case should fall within?
Your Honor, I think there's a clear definition, and the definition actually, without addressing that specific subject, the El Paso Court of Appeals, in their opinion in this case, told us what that is. Heckey and all of the cases that are cited in Heckey, like Shivers and Rogers versus Ricane and Kokol and Harrison, all were cases involving facts to substantiate.
Without a determination of excessiveness, correct?
Your Honor, I suppose that's true, but I think there is an excessiveness determination in there. I think a jury could conclude that what they're telling you...
Based upon conflicting expert
exactly
testimony.
Exactly correct. Exactly correct. I think a jury can conclude from that, without any expert testimony whatsoever, that, yeah, that breaches the contract. That breaches the express terms. It breaches the implied covenant to manage and administer, and from there. And
Mr. Hovnatanian, you obviously take the position that the category of cases that Heckey determined did not fall within the discovery rule is different than the category of cases that this case would fall in because the discovery rule should apply.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you define the category of cases that Heckey determined were excluded from the application of the discovery rule, and how would you define the category of cases that this case should fall within?
Your Honor, I think there's a clear definition, and the definition actually, without addressing that specific subject, the El Paso Court of Appeals, in their opinion in this case, told us what that is. Heckey and all of the cases that are cited in Heckey, like Shivers and Rogers versus Ricane and Kokol and Harrison, all were cases involving facts to substantiate a claim, information that were obtainable from two different sources. Either, number one, they were in public records, like Railroad Commission filings, or number two, it was open and obvious from a review of the leased premises. For instance, as the court wrote in Heckey, it would be possible for the landowners to go out and look over the fence and see the wells and know that they weren't the only ones producing from that common reservoir. This case, on the other hand, said the El Paso Court of Appeals, doesn't fall into that category because there was no way for us to know the facts giving rise to our claim, either from public records or from
just a review of the lease premises.
Why isn't that going to be true in 99% of the commercial contract cases? The only way you know if the guy that you're dealing with across the table is accounting to you properly is to ask him and do an audit. It's all internal. What if this were a contract rivalry to buy all the output of a or the supplier said, I'll sell you everything I'm putting out? And the only way you could find out if he's living up to that contract is to ask him and audit him. Why do we apply the discovery rule in all these commercial cases?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest not. I would just suggest only in those cases where really and truly there's no other place to go for the person seeking the information.
Well, in my example, I say I want all your widgets. And the supplier says, yes, you're getting all my widgets and sends me a letter to that effect every month. It turns out he's supplying three other people. But the only way I could find that out was to go ask him. Why would the discovery rule apply in that case?
Then I think it would, absolutely. And Your Honor, and I want to answer your question going one step further. I know I'm treading on Chief Justice's good graces here, but Paul Morris, Canyon's own president, testified in the record that after 1994, when the new contracts that apply in this case took effect, there was no way for the respondents to find out what Canyon was charging them from a public source. And if there's no way for us to learn that from a public source,
well, in my example, how do you learn from a public source that what the widget output is of my supplier?
Your Honor, I don't know. I would presume not. I would presume that you could not. But that's why I think perhaps that case would be proper for the discovery rule. And I think that's the answer, Justice Hankinson, to your question. If the category is different because we don't have any other source for this information, which was not true in Heckey and the cases on which Heckey relied.
Anything further?
Well, one. So your real bottom line is that if the only source of their information is the other side, then the discovery rule is going to apply in every category that involves that fact.
Your Honor, I wouldn't want to go that far. I wouldn't want to speak that broadly because I don't think I have to in this case.
I'm not saying that, but that's what the rule would be if we buy into your viewpoint.
Well, Your Honor, no, I don't think it would be. I think if you stick to the Heckey category scheme, and this court in Heckey defined Heckey's category very narrowly. I think if you define our category as breach of express terms or breach of the implied covenant to manage and administer the lease, then you don't have that problem. If you stick to the narrow framework that you set out in Heckey, I don't think you would be speaking too broadly to cover cases you don't intend to cover.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
Please, the court briefly. To begin with, again, we're leading with a request to remand in this case, but I think that the rules are very clear that this is preserved and this court can do what it needs to do with the issue of fraudulent concealment here, both under the associated indemnity case and the rule that really applies is Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 53.4, which allows that to be raised in a reply on a motion for rehearing or at any time that this court still has jurisdiction to optionally consider that. To address a few of the questions, Justice O'Neill, particularly the damage model, you are correct that it necessarily requires a testing of an unreasonableness. If you look at the pleadings in this case, which you have to go back to, and in fairness to Mr. Hovnatanian, he wasn't in this case at the time these pleadings were made and ruled upon. But the pleadings aren't about fraud. They're not about these statements versus those statements. The pleadings are about excessive post-production charges.
Are you saying that there could never be an objectively verifiable claim that satisfies the all-type test if there can be a battle of experts?
I think that there are some, as the court noted, I believe it was an SB, that there might be an expert opinion so near consensus that it would satisfy that, but we don't have such an opinion here in determining reasonableness.
But there is a standard in the industry here, is there not?
Actually, their expert's report is conditioned upon or predicated upon the notion that there are no comparable sales or charges, if you will, in the field, and therefore I have to go to what we would call a rate-making analysis. We're not sure that that's true, but even if there were a standard methodology, for example, in a case where you're valuing property by comparative sales, the methodology may be consensus. But that doesn't make the opinion consensus, because if the opinion still relies on subjective standards such as reasonableness, you lack that consensus that the court was pointing to, we believe, to get there. Secondly, I ticked off the reasons quickly that there are a number of other sources, but Justice Owen's question was very pertinent. You could have asked for the contracts. You could have calculated these, and it was conceded that you could have. The information was available. We disagree vehemently with the characterization of the facts that they called and said, Allsafe tells us you're overcharging us. Read the briefs, read the records. That's not what happened. 18 months later, and when you see what that conversation was, you'll wonder, I believe, why we were having this discussion to begin with. But nevertheless, the medical doctor example was a good one. All you have to do is go further. Let me see the contract. Let me understand the allowance that you're giving us that makes this accurate, and I'll decide whether I agree with that or disagree with it. But there's no question but what that information was available. Also would point out that the Advent Trust case, which counsel cited, does not reach a discovery rule analysis.
Can you tell me what the status of that case is?
I do not know. I apologize. I cannot. Petition denied. Thank you, Mr. Obnatanian. It does not reach the issue that's before this court. He's a gentleman. They both are throughout. And in fact, what it does is criticize HECI in a footnote in dicta. And we think that that's one of the reasons, unfortunately, even having written a trilogy, that you need clarification one more time about how we separate the fact-specific analysis versus a categorical or type of case analysis. In summary, I think Mr. Glass said it best when I was asking him about the Allsafe report, and he summed up the reason we have limitations. Man, I don't remember. That's been 14 years ago.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.